You can keep up with all the episodes of the Journalism Salute by checking out our newsletter. The link is at the bottom of the show notes. Hope you'll subscribe. And let us know where you're listening from and what you think of the podcast. Email us at journalismsalute@gmail.com. Thank you. Hi and welcome to the Journalism Salute. I'm Mark Simon. In each episode, we'll talk to or about an interesting person or organization related to journalism. The intent is to show that journalists are not the enemy of the people. Thank you for listening. On this episode, we're joined by Jay Bowler. Jay is co-owner and editor of Racket. Racket, racketmn.com, is a writer-owned, reader-funded alternative journalism source for news, arts, and culture in Minneapolis. He has previously worked for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and City Pages. Racket was founded in August 2021. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here.
All right. So we start same way that we start with everyone. What is your personal journalism origin story?
I went to the University of Minnesota, which is my hometown college. I grew up in South Minneapolis, and just kind of by chance, because I like to read. Yeah, mostly because I like to read. I gravitated toward the journalism school and got enrolled there and kind of immediately fell into the Minnesota Daily, which is this really great campus newspaper at the University of Minnesota. It's one of the longest running, one of the historically strongest campus papers in the country. And I got a job in the A&E department writing about music, movies, food, all that, and just fell in love with the rhythms of the newsroom, with just kind of everything about the industry as it existed in, 2008. Which is a lot different. One of the big things that grabbed me initially was this giant wall of CDs that record labels had emailed the paper. And in 2008, before like MP3s really took off, that was like the coolest perk of a job you could imagine, to have access to all these free albums, which that changed rather quickly. But from there, I got an internship at the Star Tribune, which is the major daily paper in Minneapolis, and worked for their kind of alt-weekly startup called Vitamin. And when the Star Tribune Media Company, which is owned by Glenn Taylor, he's a Republican billionaire, and he kind of bought the paper sort of as a sort of like a civic pride pinky ring, I think. But for whatever blessings and curses came with that, it stabilized a pretty unstable paper from the business end. And one of his moves was to buy City Pages, which was the alt-weekly in town that had existed for since 1979, I want to say. And Vitamin became redundant at that point. So they folded that and then folded me into City Pages. And from 2015 until 2020, during the heart of the pandemic, I was there when we were kind of unceremoniously shut down. COVID was blamed. I'm sure that's part of the truth. But yeah, we received a warning that morning that we had a big urgent meeting, and the meeting ended up being that without any attempts of like reducing page size or reducing staff or really any measures to try and save this local journalism institution, they were just kind of doing away with it. And that's when we were kind of in the desert and didn't know where to go from there.
So just to go back slightly, yeah. is there anyone or anything in your background or family or heritage that lends itself to storytelling?
No, not really. I'm the first member of my immediate family to go to college. My parents worked blue collar jobs. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, I come from big, loud Irish Catholic families, so like drunk stories are just kind of baked into that, but nothing in like the formal or certainly professional sense.
All right. Well, that's been referenced a few times on this podcast. Yeah. So it doesn't, that totally fits with the storytelling journalist aspect of things. All right. So let's talk Racket, racketmn.com. So this is fascinating to me. I had wanted to do something on an outlet of this type. There's your group, there's Defector, there's 404 Media, there's a few others as well. There's Hellgate in New York City.
Yeah, well, at the time that we found ourselves without jobs, but thankfully with very generous COVID-era kind of severance packages and government aid, which provided a really nice kind of launch period to figure out what we were going to do, Defector had sort of just emerged. I think they were maybe like 8 months old or something. We sent out a letter to, I think we had an editorial staff of maybe 12 people, And we sent out an email saying, hey, it's a dumb idea to start a journalism startup in 2020 during a pandemic, but we feel like we'd owe it to ourselves to at least try. Who wants in? And of the 12 people, myself and three colleagues were the ones who wanted to give it a shot. So we didn't really know where to go at all. Defector had enjoyed this really huge launch where they immediately got like 50,000 subscribers or something. They had headlines in the New York Times. So they were kind of the talk of the industry. So I cold emailed Tom Lay, one of their editors, and had never met any of them, had no personal relationships or even like Twitter relationships with them, and told him our situation. And within, I think, an hour, he had emailed back and said, I'd be happy to take a meeting with you. We got on a video call with him, and I think I quite literally said, how can we copy everything that you're doing? Tom gave us the contact info for the president of the company that worked as their developer, Ali Lead. We immediately emailed this person at Ali Lead, and he emailed back again within an hour. It all felt very kind of fortuitous for us. And he said, you'd have no reason to know this, but I went to college in St. Paul, Minnesota, and loved City Pages. And it would be my honor to help bring a digital version of that back to life. That set off a partnership with Ali Lead that exists through today. And we had a very slow buildup through late 2020 and early 2021, where we taught ourselves what a value proposition was. We went through logo design process. We pooled $1,000 each in startup money. That was the grand total that we invested. And that was a big perk of Ali Lead. They kept the development costs almost at nothing in terms of starting up. And in return, take a profit share chunk of subscription revenue. So kind of a roll of the dice for them. But the way we looked at it is we really had nothing to lose outside of those $4,000 and maybe a chunk of time that felt like it was being sort of in a liminal weird space anyway, because it was the height of COVID. But actually, after we got done talking with Tom over the phone, Tom Lay from Defector, he emailed us back with a very encouraging note that we all still remember, saying, frankly, I think you guys would be foolish not to give this a try. So that vote of confidence from a total stranger, I think, went a long way. And in August of 2021, like you said, we rolled out this product with no expectations of what would happen. And the value proposition, which is one of many, many business terms we kind of fake taught ourselves because none of us are business people, was effectively boiled down to, if you like City Pages, you might like Racket. And of course, City Pages is a very well-known entity in our town. Yeah, that brought us to launch day where there were zero expectations at all.
So what was how did you decide on the tone and voice of what it would be?
That whole part was really, really easy for us because we all came up in kind of the Alt Weekly universe, which I talk at colleges around town every now and then. And at this point, 0% of young people know what an Alt Weekly is, which I kind of think speaks to the, I wouldn't even call it a rapid death. It was kind of a gradual death of that form of that format of journalism. But yeah, the Alt Weekly tone was kind of baked into the way we operated. In addition to, I mean, I grew up reading Deadspin and Gawker and all of these sort of digital first, I guess, blogs you'd call them at the time. So the sort of like blog voice too was baked in as well. And I think with that Alt Weekly understanding, just a general sort of humorous tone, a bit of a sarcasm element, a skepticism of power, an outsider kind of perspective, and all of that, again, felt very natural. There was no real like scheming or like plotting to arrive at voice, because outside of being ignorant of literally every other element of the job, we knew how to do the job itself. So that part came very easy. It's just literally everything else was what was a big question mark.
So there's four of you. How did you divvy up the duties in terms of what you do?
I am kind of like the utility player. I've even at City Pages covered just about everything. My colleague Keith Harris, to my mind, and he has yet to be embarrassed of me saying this, so I'm going to keep saying it, I think is a top 10 music writer in the entire world. He's that good. He has bylines from all the major music outlets you'd expect. My colleague Em Castle, she worked as food editor and then eventually editor-in-chief at City Pages. And she kind of owned the food realm and the bike stuff and the transit stuff. And then Jessica Armbrister, my other colleague, she, for I think over 20 years at City Pages, worked doing events coverage and just sort of like the planning your weekend, planning your week type of arts and entertainment and arts coverage that was one of the backbones of the Alt Weekly model to tell people what's in town, what's happening, how to spend your time and money.
Grand scheme of all this, what's it been like for the last 3-4 years?
Yeah, well, it launched like in our craziest just moments of like daydreaming, like, oh, maybe if Defector got 50,000 people to subscribe right away, maybe we'll get 10, who knows? But ultimately that didn't happen. I think week one, we got about 800 people. Which moment, it became very clear this was going to be a very tough uphill fight with very lean years in the beginning. But yeah, in terms of, again, doing the day-to-day work, never an issue there. That was fine. It's just been kind of clawing our way through the business end of things to figure out how to add more people, how to make brand awareness, kind of saturate our market, which, I mean, of course, we're thought of as a flyover market or whatever, but in terms of total size of the Twin Cities metro area, I think like the number 14 biggest media market in the country, if not higher. So like there are a lot of people here who can spend money on news, and it's a very literate community. It's a very civically engaged community. So we know there are a lot of customers out there. It was a matter of letting them know who we are and then hopefully, fingers crossed, spending money on us. And we came up in an era of Twin Cities media where a lot of startups did start popping up. There's the Sahan Journal, which has a kind of an immigrant focus, and they're a grant machine and doing incredibly well. They've grown exponentially over there. The Minnesota Reformer is part of the state's newsroom project. They're doing incredible work, and a handful of other ones too. But we were the first sort of like Alt Weekly modeled outlet saying, if you like us, please give us money, which kind of totally uncharted territory. And happy to report from a business end, we're approaching 4,000 subscribers today. And knock on wood, if our projections for this year are accurate, by year three, we will have reached our enormous City Pages salaries, but we will be making what we made when we got laid off. Which, yeah, after those first years when we, I think, were federally under like the definition of poverty, it's a nice milestone to hopefully reach.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how you get by in a situation like that.
Obviously, the cost of living here is not what it is on either coast. We're buddies with the guys at Hellgate, who you mentioned, and for them or anyone else operating out of New York or LA, just I can't imagine how much of your early meager startup money gets devoted to having a $3,000 a month apartment or whatever. So not that much of an issue here where things are still relatively affordable. But on top of that, we all went in with the understanding this would be a full-time job. Like with the four of us in agreeing to partner said, this will be a minimum 40 hours a week that you'll put into it. But beyond that, I have a couple other side jobs. Em has a couple other side jobs too. So yeah, I mean, it in a perfect world, we'd be devoting every bit of energy to Racket. In the actual world, we're devoting 90% of our energy to it.
What do you do when you guys disagree?
We're waiting for our first giant blow up. It hasn't happened yet. There's not even been like a really tense moment where we've like had a half fight. So I think that speaks to working together for a long time and knowing how to work together. But yeah, I mean, like I'm not naive enough to think that like we're incapable of getting in a fight, but it's not really come up yet, which is, I think, a uniquely blessed situation we've been in. But I'm sure it's bound to happen at some point. But the disagreements have been incredibly small so far.
One of the things that I liked was the fact that I saw in one of your things that said no story quotas, which is certainly a big deal. So I want to use that to segue into the kinds of things that you do write about, because you get to write about what you want to write about. And one of those, first one that I want to look at, is the kind of piece that I think I was expecting out of an organization like yours. You spent a day at a wealth creation event at a megachurch whose speakers included Tim Tebow and took highly detailed notes, my favorite being that the food came from a fast food chain that wasn't in Minnesota. So how the heck did it get here? It was like a commentary combined with a painting the picture of what exactly this was. Can you walk us through this one from idea to execution?
Yeah, a reader actually tweeted at us saying Racket has to cover this, which is evidence of at least some people understanding the model and what we're trying to accomplish. And I went online and I bought my $27 ticket and drove out to Eden Prairie, which is a kind of a second ring suburb of the Twin Cities, to one of the largest mega churches in the metro, and had no idea what to expect. And I was immediately taken aback by how incredibly sold out this entire thing was. I think it was a 2,500 seat church, and there weren't any empty seats in the place. And I arrived with an open mind, to the extent that, like, you can have an open mind about an event like that if it had provided, I don't know, cheap entertainment and like a worthwhile afternoon out for believers who wanted entertainment and distraction. Sure, I would have come away with that understanding. But what I came away with was just a truly vile, vile display of preying on people in a financial sense. Of course, the marquee talent was Tim Tebow and the Duck Dynasty guy and Annie's Pretzels, who's a real woman who created the pretzel empire. But they just kind of like gave phoned in little performances and talks. But for the most part, it was these just creepy, creepy salesmen who made everything from public speaking to day trading to, I forget, real estate investment seem as easy as flipping on a light switch when you have the power of God. And after each talk, these teams of people with clipboards would be deployed around the entire church to sign people up for these incredibly expensive classes, which would then really show you how easy it is to make a ton of money when you have God on your side. Which the whole God element was just so underplayed throughout that it felt tacked on with every presentation. It was like, and you can expect this much money trading stocks online, because in Ecclesiastes 5:49, it says money is proof of God or something. It's like, oh, well, you didn't really put in the work to like make it seem biblically rooted. But the most depressing element was people were just signing up in droves for these classes. And as you mentioned, I took pretty very detailed notes through the, I think, 10-hour presentation. And at one point, like after the mystery lunch had arrived and we were just getting more of this really cynical hard selling of complete hucksterism, I wrote in my notebook, purely for myself, "I want to die," in all caps. And this very sweet woman next to me, who was also taking diligent notes, but from like a real true believer perspective, leaned over and she said, "What did you write for that one? I missed it." And I didn't want to like insult her. So I was like, "I missed it too." And just, of course, didn't tell her what I'd actually written down.
So as I said, a piece like this, I would expect to read it. It felt very Village Voice-y to me, which was kind of cool. How often do you do reader suggested pieces like that?
Oh, really quite often. I mean, I'm sure people have said something to this effect, but like beyond the fact that journalism is a bad job because you have no way of making money, it's also one of the unique jobs where you have a homework assignment literally every single day, and that's coming up with a new story to write, and then executing that homework assignment. So we take ideas wherever they come from. And readers, we're very fortunate to have a very dedicated base of those 4,000-ish people who pay to read us. And they're not shy about emailing us whenever they think there's something that Racket should look into. So yeah, we are not precious about where the ideas come from at all. If they come from anywhere, if they're good, we'll pursue them as much as we can.
On a more serious note, you also wrote about Milepost 7, which is an environmental piece about a stretch of water that most people don't know exists that stores polluting runoff from a mining company, and it's about to get bigger. It's a potential environmental hazard that could impact Lake Superior. This is different. This is a much more serious kind of piece. How comprehensive was the work that you had to do on this one?
Yeah, that idea came from, I my wife and I are big fans of the North Shore, which is the stretch of Minnesota along Lake Superior, just in terms for hiking and for vacationing and all that. For years, when I would bring up the Google Map version of the North Shore, there would be this glowing oval that was hundreds of times larger than any town located along the shore. and it was kind of teetering above it, above the lake. And sure enough, it was called Milepost 7, and it's what's known as a tailings basin, which is where the polluted water from mining operations, in this case taconite production, are stored in perpetuity in these concrete pools. With there is no plan for it. There's never a plan for any of them. They just are ideally will sit there without a crack ever forming, without a rupture ever being caused. The Milepost 7 one has a long and fascinating history where for years and years and years, mining runoff was dumped directly into Lake Superior just above Duluth. And it started causing these enormous poisonous plumes in the water. So in the 1970s, in the federal courts, it was mandated that the mining companies had to do something with this water, which is put it in this growing lake that kind of teeters above Lake Superior. So in talking with a bunch of environmental experts and mining experts and hearing stories from around the globe of these tailings basins failing and causing these avalanches of poison water to hit communities in Brazil and elsewhere around the globe, we kind of rang the alarm that our Department of Natural Resources was appeared to be rubber stamping an expansion of this tailings basin, which is not the biggest one in Minnesota, but it's perched above a universally beloved natural resource and an increasingly important one in Lake Superior. So I think that that element really grabbed people, but we kind of caught the DNR off guard and sort of exposed them for not really being as transparent as they could be with the public about this even happening and when it was going to happen and if it was going to happen. So the piece ended up being this kind of in-depth history of how the pool of toxic water formed and how the public is not necessarily being told the total story of what's going to happen to it. But the readership, mostly almost exclusively Minnesotans, mostly didn't know about this. So to the extent that you didn't know about it as a non-Minnesotan, people right here at home didn't either. So I think it was very instructive for that reason, too.
What are the most popular kind of pieces on your site? Are they more the, for lack of a better word, like commentaries on things like going to the mega church, or are they more the serious expose type pieces?
Well, that's really funny. I mean, I'm sure a lot of folks you've had on have alluded to how there's just no real way to predict what will hit. So, for example, the church story and the poison pool story, those both, thank God, did very, very well and were among our most popular of the year. But other times you'll put in a ton of work on a multi-source, rigorously researched piece and no one will read it. And whatever, you don't know what to do with that. But other times, something will really, really take off. And the one example I can think of for us was we ranked all of the rotisserie chickens available in supermarkets around the Twin Cities. And we were like really, really, really mean to the worst ones. We just like bullied the hell out of these chickens, which deserved it because they taste bad and are, I don't want to say bad for you, but certainly taste bad and look bad. But in ranking those 8 birds, we got over 100,000 views. And I'm sure a lot of that was reader interest in like what kind of chicken they should buy around town. But the other part is like the algorithmic, just like mystery of Google and the social networks and all that, that I think propelled this very goofy chicken ranking to heights, which I think we've accepted in our heart of hearts, we will never, ever reach again. So that's kind of like the dragon we're chasing. Our dragon is just like a twirling bird, but yeah.
Be mean to the chickens. That's how you get it done. On that note,
in fairness, we were very kind to the good chickens too, but yeah, it went both ways.
On that note, a non-racket piece. I do want to address this just briefly because I thought it was a fun piece. You once wrote about the closing of a McDonald's. What can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, I wrote about the closing of the McDonald's and I wrote about the reopening very recently in Racket. So it kind of comes full circle, but right next to the U of M campus, there's a neighborhood called Dinkytown. It's where Bob Dylan got his first stage time. It's just kind of the little college neighborhood. And from the 1970s on, there was this really, I guess by the time it closed, it was unique, but it was kind of an old campy 1970s style McDonald's. And it was a McDonald's, of course, and during the day, just fed hungry students. But at nighttime, it became something known as Drunk Donald's because it would transform, because it was open beyond bar close, into like a de facto nightclub where just lewd and crazy and disgusting things would happen. And for decades, it became this fixture of campus life where, like, after the bars closed, which in Minnesota up until like 15 years ago got bumped to 2 a.m., but before that it was 1 a.m., so still fairly early in the night, you would go and bring, like, sneak a bottle of liquor into the Drunk Donald's, and the party would keep going there. And it was just etched in the memories of generations of U of M students as that. So when it closed, I wrote kind of a weepy obituary that got quotes from folks who had frequented it, some, as I alluded to, very, very lewd quotes about things that had happened in there. But I think it's passing to make way for this giant kind of mixed-use development building. Bummed a lot of people out, understandably, even though the density crowd cheered it, and we're pro-density, so that's great too. But when it reopened as, in terms of its aesthetics, effectively like a bank lobby McDonald's, the kind of McDonald's you see all the time nowadays, I reached out to the architecture critic at The Nation magazine to help me explain what a vile affront to just tastefulness this completely devoid of humanity McDonald's is. And with the understanding throughout all of this that even the funky McDonald's was still like a soulless multinational corporation. And this new one, of course, visually at least, really leans into that. And I both were met with a lot of readership, so we tapped into something there.
Is that the most fun part of the job for you, writing stories like that?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I'm a total townie. I've never left Minneapolis. I've never lived anywhere else. So, like, honing in on these just institutions that, I use the term institution very, very broadly here, these beloved places or uniquely reviled places or any really specific geographic place to my hometown, again, which I've never, ever left. And knowing that among fellow townies, it will resonate in a deep emotional way. That's a fun little magic trick to have, which I think speaks to the kind of hyper-local nature of what we do. Would the Drunk Donald story play anywhere else in the country? Probably not, because you kind of had to be there kind of blind drunk at 2 a.m. eating a McChicken for it. It's magic to really hit you, you know?
For reference, we did do a conversation with someone in Charlottesville talking about covering the neighborhoods there. And she said that one of her more popular and more interesting stories was the opening of a bathroom. So it all kind of fits, going hyper-local, whether you're in a smaller city like a Charlottesville or whether you're in a bigger place like a Minneapolis. Totally. Certainly fits. What are some other good stories that have gotten racket good attention?
I'm just going to make this very selfishly about myself because my colleagues aren't here to chime in. One of the beats that I've sort of taken on is the, not media critic, but media reporter, which is a dying beat. Every newspaper in the country used to have one. Now there are almost none. So one of our first real big home run stories was I did an investigative piece into what's happening at Minnesota Public Radio. And the what's happening element was they couldn't retain jobs at all. That was a combination of layoffs happening, of people quitting, of people jumping ship to other outlets. And every time it would happen, I would just G-chat with colleagues in the journalism industry and say, like, what the hell is going on over there? So I did the easy part, which is getting journalists to complain about work, and ended up calling, I think, close to 20 current and former staffers at NPR and asked, why can't they retain anyone? And what was revealed to me in the reporting process was they operate much like a bloodthirsty for-profit corporation, even though they're this hand-holdy, feel-good, kumbaya, nonprofit public radio station. And I was ready to go to print or to our digital print equivalent with just that. But I had to send, of course, the perfunctory email to their management to say, hey, I talked to almost 20 people. They said a lot of bad things about how things are run over there. Care to comment? And I fully anticipated getting just a boilerplate like PR letter back being like, oh, we value all employees and hope they all have a nice time or whatever. But through some just odd stroke of luck, they invited me to talk to two of the higher ups at the institution, including the president, who happens to be the daughter of the person who owns the Star Tribune. We have our own little Nepo empire of media executives here. And in that conversation, they were incredibly defensive and dismissive and clearly insulted, and it just added, through no doing of my own, they added a lot of ammunition to this view of how they were being talked about by saying all of the wrong things. And I think that piece really resonated. And then last fall, I did a similar piece about the Pioneer Press, which is our St. Paul paper, which has been on on death watch for, God, decades at this point. But I wanted to focus in on how Alden Global Capital, which I'm sure is a name you've heard on your podcast, it's known as like the vampire killer of newspapers. It's a hedge fund. What life has been like under Alden for the past 15 years. And surprise, surprise, terrible. They've drained every resource. Yep. The newsroom has shrunk from 200 people to like, I think 35 now. And they're just running around like maniacs trying to keep this major daily paper afloat under the worst ownership kind of conceivable in the industry. So those have been really rewarding to cover too. And I think, again, speaks to the kind of alt-weekly role where I don't want a job at any of these places, so I can report on them however I see fit, which is kind of telling the truth about how they're run.
There's a nice freedom to it, certainly, as you're describing. But what's the hardest part of the job for you?
The hardest part, I mean, has been, I'll be honest, achieving the level of pay we had when we were employed by the Star Tribune Media Company at City Pages. So, I mean, yeah, the hardest part has been just really having to think constantly, not only about where the next story is going to come from, but about how business growth will happen, about how subscriber acquisition will happen, about how to kind of keep this thing not only just like floating along, but also growing, is an additional pressure that, of course, in most mainstream newsrooms, entire departments and divisions have to handle that question, whereas we have to try and not make it an afterthought, but it kind of becomes an afterthought just because you only have so much time in the week. But yeah, I would say just the business element of running a news operation has been something we've taught ourselves in real time and continue to try and make time for. But the industry is obviously not doing well, and so fighting those prevailing winds while doing the job itself is always tricky.
Has anyone ever, or have you ever considered bringing in a fifth person to be like the business person?
Yeah, we contracted an ad rep out for our first couple of years, and we just moved on to a new ad rep who, ads are pretty low in our pie chart of where funding comes from. It's overwhelmingly reader support, but we have been told by many people who know more about what they're talking about than we do that the ad element could be grown. So we've outsourced that, which is great to think about. Great not to think about, and also to have the kind of firewall between editorial and advertising. In terms of like the in-house business number crunching, it's on our sort of like long list of things we'd like to do maybe one day, but I think financially we just want to get to a place where we're for sure 100% comfortable between the four of us before we can kind of partition off more of that pie chart to other people.
What does the list look like in terms of next things that you want to do from an editorial perspective?
We would love to add another staff member, of course, but in the meantime, we've made a point of paying freelancers really fairly because we've all been freelancers and we are writers and we're workers and we know what it's like to be offered $100 for like a 5-source feature story that's 2,000 words and how insulting that can be. So we shoot for 20 cents a word, which is for this market a very good rate. And we've devoted, I think, we publish all of our finances on a year-end report on our website. So the exact number is there somewhere, but we've paid around 30 grand a year to freelance writing, which is, I guess, a little over half of what a staff job would be if we considered our job staff jobs. So investing in that, at least in the short term, investing even more would be great. And then maybe adding another editorial staffer would be great too.
This being Minnesota and this having happened, George Floyd having happened in Minnesota, how does your outlet cover race and race relations in the city?
None of us come from a hard news background, the four of us. So we've had to kind of teach ourselves in real time to cover harder news like that. But in the meantime, we can always lean into the more A&E aligned, arts entertainment aligned coverage we've done. And a lot of that has been just profiling social justice groups around town and organizations and artists and musicians and kind of approach it from that sort of softer angle. Because there are other outlets in town who do that harder racial justice reporting better than we can. I mentioned Sahan Journal earlier, that's kind of their bread and butter and they do an incredible job of it. So with that sort of more sensitive reporting, we've just kind of made it more through a lens of arts and entertainment rather than any sort of like hard news, day-to-day coverage of a trial of an officer or anything like that.
Gotcha. How has being a journalist shaped how you view the world?
Oh, wow. What a great question. I've never really thought about that. So forgive me as I sort of like rack my brain in real time here. It's easy to say that like you become more cynical as a journalist because you're kind of exposed to just power at every level, either being incompetent or at worst crooked. And if you read stories all day, every day, like I do, and you also write them, you obviously see a ton of that. But at the same time, like I mentioned, with the sort of more culture journalism that we do, you meet people every single day who are doing inspiring things and doing things to make the community a better place and to just really believe in helping people. I think that those two dueling forces have illustrated sort of either totem in my mind, where I'm more cynical and I'm more hopeful at the same time. And that might be mathematically incompatible, but it's kind of how I feel.
I feel like there's about 50 answers to the next question, the next to last one I'm going to ask, but I'll ask it anyway, and I'll just look ideally for one. The future of this type of media and what you're doing depends on more people choosing to be brave and to start up something like this. What suggestions do you have for those people as they pursue it?
Yeah, we think about and are asked a lot about the sort of defector, Hellgate, 404 media racket model, which is worker-owned, mostly reader-supported, and whether that is the sort of, maybe this is the wrong metaphor, the magic bullet, the secret sauce, the whatever, the future of the industry. And I really, really, really want to say, yeah, I want to encourage it because it has worked for the most part for us. At the same time, the question of scale is talked about all the time. And I don't know how big racket can get. I feel like comfortably bigger. But if we were in a media market where there was another outlet that does pretty much the same thing racket is doing, I don't know if there would be enough money in terms of reader dollars to support both. So how much of it depends on like how early you get to the enterprise you want to create and be reader funded. I think that that's a real question. So this model can definitely work in a sort of boutique way. Is it going to solve the flood avalanche of daily papers that are folding throughout the country? I don't think so. I don't know what the model is for that. I don't think anyone knows. But in terms of our thing, what we're doing, I think if there's room for it, if there's space for it to breathe and kind of exist as a value proposition, a thing that only you can get from this particular outlet and it's worth paying for, I feel great about it, obviously. I mean, we're a pro-union shop, and the next logical evolution of trade unionism is the workers owning the damn thing themselves, which is what we have. And we're very proud of that and happy about that.
So the show is called The Journalism Salute. We salute you for your good work, and we ask that you do likewise. Is there a journalist or journalism organization that you would like to salute for their good work? Comma, please don't pick Defector or another of that ilk.
I'm going to pick Minnesota Reformer, part of the state's newsroom, which is a network of papers. I believe they're a nonprofit. And initially, they get dogged for this a lot. Initially, a Democratic like super PAC was responsible for part of the seed funding for all these newsrooms, which they've since severed from that. They're no longer a left-wing dark money funded operation. But Minnesota Reformer has done the most dogged progressive reporting in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota in recent memory. They, in terms of the level of ferociousness they exhibit, it puts our daily papers to shame. They've gone after 3M for poisoning our water with forever chemicals. They've gone after just all of these sort of untouchable Fortune 500 institutions in Minnesota, like, oh, the names are going to escape me, but like Mayo Clinic, like 3M, all these prestige brands that I think for whatever reason were soft on because they've been around forever and they're huge. But the Reformer, with that and with their police reporting too in Minneapolis, have been just ferocious and dogged and irreplaceable. They've done incredible work.
For taking the time to join us. Best of luck. Hoping it succeeds. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
What do you do when you guys disagree?
We're waiting for our first giant blow up. It hasn't happened yet. There's not even been like a really tense moment where we've like had a half fight. So I think that speaks to working together for a long time and knowing how to work together. But yeah, I mean, like I'm not naive enough to know to think that like we're incapable of getting in a fight, but it's not really come up yet, which is, I think, a uniquely blessed situation we've been in. But I'm sure it's bound to happen at some point. But the disagreements have been incredibly small so far.